welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Jessica with Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. I am very honored to have our guest here today. And usually a delay in a book release is not fortuitous, but being that Turn the Page has been somewhat backed up as far as interviews and getting things out. And I think that this this book is, while I think it's an evergreen topic, I would very much like to get this out closer to the release date of the book. The supply chain has given us a gift, and this interview will be coming out much closer to the release date of the book. So I'm going to stop talking, and I'm going to allow our guest to introduce himself and tell us about this book that is coming out now.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me, Jessica, and for everyone at Syosset Library. This book, Correctional, and as Jessica mentioned, just came out the first week of January. So it's brand new. It came out with University of Wisconsin Press. And it really is, it's a memoir, and it tells a number of different stories. Tells the story of my parents' immigration to the US from South India, and me growing up biculturally in Northern Virginia, and then moving back to India as a very young boy to take care of my grandmother. And then it kind of flashes forward and discusses my life in New York, where I went to graduate school and lived through 9/11, and then had these unexpected encounters with the criminal justice system. And so the core of the story is first about this wrongful arrest that I had, and then a time where I actually was guilty and violated my probation by driving on a suspended license and had to do 90 days at Hartford Correctional Center at the very moment that I was going up for promotion to full professor at a Connecticut university. And so that's the core of the story. And it's really about the men that I met, the experience that I had of what I knew theoretically, but that viscerally experiencing mass incarceration firsthand really changed my perspective in a big way. And so it's about the men I met and what I learned and how I kind of came through this really difficult moment of my life to emerge on the other side, hopefully wiser and kinder.
That is a very good overview of everything. And I think the first thing I just want to chat a little bit about is, you know, you talk a lot about the men that you met and just sort of the way that the system works once you're incarcerated, or doesn't work rather. Did you want to kind of give an overview just as to what you expected? I mean, what does one expect, but what you expected going in, and then just sort of how the layers were peeled back as you were experiencing it real time?
Yeah, I think like many people, my whole conception of jail was based on Oz and Prison Break and television shows like that. I was really honestly terrified. I mean, when I went in, and it wasn't like that. I wasn't in a cell. I was in a dorm with 60 other men. There was dorm A and dorm B, so 60 other men on the other side. I would say probably about 95% men of color, African-American, Latino-American. And you spent most of your time, they have these bunk beds, and the space that six bunk beds make is your cube. And so you have these cube mates that you spend a lot of time with. Most of the time was spent just kind of waiting, wasting your time playing cards, telling stories. I found very little in the way of rehabilitation. I, of course, am a college professor, so volunteered immediately to teach at the school or to do anything, and all my requests were ignored. You know, other than a little bit of rec time in this small prison yard that was encircled by barbed wire, and then mealtime, you're just basically in this enclosed space. And what I found was, rather than preparing these men to reenter society, that there was a kind of casual sadism, and there was a dysregulation happening that was probably going to make it much harder for them to readjust when they left that space.
I think when you discuss like what you expected based on, you know, television, of course, and then just what you experienced, I mean, the idea of rehabilitation Did it seem to like that they wanted to, but there just wasn't the resources, or it just was not, the system is just not designed to rehabilitate people who are incarcerated?
You know, look, I'm not a conspiracy theorist normally, but I do know that, you know, statistically, we've spent more in this country on incarceration than education in many states over the last couple of decades. And that the criminal justice system in the U.S. has perpetually much higher rates of recidivism than many other developed countries in Europe and elsewhere. So this system is clearly broken and not working. And my sense was that there was almost an investment in failure, that it wasn't enough for these men to be taken out of society and away from their families, which is punishment enough, but that on the inside, especially away from where the public could see, they needed to be kind of punished more and stigmatized as criminal even more. And that's what I saw, rather than any workshop skills, life skills. And from my conversations with these men, when they got out, probation and parole was set up the same way. It was set up to kind of reinsure that they would reoffend in some way and get back in there.
Yeah, I can't, now I'm trying to remember if it was in the book itself or an interview I read with you, because I did some research where you were saying that it almost seemed puritanical, like shaming, in a sense.
Yeah, the roots, I think we tend to forget. And when I was looking at the crisis of mass incarceration, kind of zooming out from the big picture, and, you know, the our Puritan ancestors, when they came to this country, actually initially had what were called the bloody codes in England, the sanguinary punishments, which were all done in public, pillorings and whippings and brandings and executions. We probably remember Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter,
right, yeah.
Where you had to have that. So you were, in some ways, it was not guilt, but shame. Something that you're guilty of, you can atone for and move on. Something that you're shamed for, you are in fact criminal, and you can't ever escape that idea. And so that was the roots of the our system. And the Quakers, who were kind of the left-wing party of the time, actually thought that the system of punishment was kind of medieval and brutal, and advocated for incarceration as an alternative, where through labor and silence, which we still see today in prison workshops and solitary confinement, they felt that someone could kind of be redeemed. But my argument was that the puritanical zeal for shaming never left, but it actually kind of went underneath. And we can only see this when people get out and they have a criminal record, how hard it is for them to move on with their life in any way. They're kind of looked down upon by most of society.
Yeah, I believe almost a set up for failure. You can't really, there's no way to really atone for what you did, or to say, you know, I served my time. I'm working to better, you know, beyond that. Let's put this behind me. There's really no way to do that.
Yeah. And it was also that a lot of the men that I met might have had mental health issues or substance problems. Yeah. But they weren't being addressed in jail, and they certainly didn't, if anything, those problems were getting worse in there, not better.
I believe one of the men was a veteran.
Yes, I did meet, and this guy, Lenny, was a Vietnam vet that I met, who, you know, he was one of the few white guys that were around me. And, he actually, now that I think about it, had these remarkably prescient, he was a total conspiracy theorist, but he predicted super viruses taking over the world and climate disaster. And now in 2022, I'm looking back on some of what he said, like, oh man, he's kind of onto something. But again, yes, he was someone that as a veteran didn't feel very supported, had a drinking problem himself, and had also found himself caught in the net of incarceration.
So you had mentioned Lenny was one of the few white guys you were with. So clearly those incarcerated, the percentage of people of color was, I mean, much higher. If Lenny was definitely in the minority.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, we think of statistics, which I know, I mean, there's a great book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, where she outlines some of this. But I think
it is a great book. Yeah.
Terrific book. Yeah, I think everyone should read it. But that for African-American male born in 2001, there was a 1 in 3 chance that they would be arrested, right? And so when you look at sentencing, who is arrested, how long they're arrested for, all of these things, there's a racial disproportionate quality that I knew theoretically having read it. But then going into Hartford Correctional and experiencing it firsthand, it was overwhelming. I mean, it was incontestable that there was a racial dimension here. And many of the men that I talked to had had their first entanglements with the law, maybe as a young man, as a teenager, smoking a joint and getting arrested and having a criminal record then, and not kind of being able to move on. And I also recognize the ripple effect that this has had, because in many cases they had a parent who had been affected by mass incarceration. And then when you're unable to be with your family and hold down a job, there is this kind of generational damage that happens. And I witnessed that firsthand.
Yeah, that is something I think that I've been reading about a lot lately as well. And it's really just, it is heartbreaking. And when you think about, I mean, in general, how society treats, when you talk about mental illness and people of color in general, who are not incarcerated, it's not great. And one can, unfortunately, you didn't have to imagine it. You saw firsthand what it's like on the other side.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that the two great moments of prison growth in American history, one came at the end of the 1960s, at the end of the Civil War, in the post-Reconstructionist South, where now there's a plantation to prison pipeline and convict leasing laws, where states would get convicts, inmates from other states to do all the work they didn't want to do, work on the railroads and the mines and other things. And then the other great moment came at the end of the 1970s, at the end of the Civil Rights era. And, you know, when just doing research into this, I didn't realize how a modern a phenomenon that this is, that in 1980, there was less than 300,000 people incarcerated. And as of last year, there were more than 2.2 million. So in the last 40 odd years, a nearly 1,000% increase. And are we any safer or better off? It feels like this has been happening under our nose, under the nose of American democracy, and we've somehow allowed it to happen. And it's really disturbing.
So when you talk about versus how incarceration or how correction is treated in other countries, did you do any research into what seems to be maybe a more successful way of actually rehabilitating people who find themselves incarcerated?
Yeah, one example, I think the Scandinavian countries do pretty well, and Norway in particular, which has one of the lowest recidivism rates of any country in the world. And they actually treat their prisoners as humans. And so I've actually seen some of the Norwegian jails look better than brownstones in Brooklyn that I've lived in the past. Pretty nice buildings, but you're kind of given a key, you're given access to a stove. There are classes there. There are counselors there. You can take writing workshops and work on the things that might have gotten you there in the first place. And as a result, people don't go back to jail. And there also aren't executions or life sentences. And so, you know, these people will be back in society. And so you're prepping them for far less money, I should say. I mean, that's the other thing. In Rhode Island, where I am now, I think it costs almost $80,000 a year to incarcerate an inmate, about 3/4 of which is spent on security personnel. So what if that money could somehow be used for other things in the community? What effects would it have? You know, that's what I ask myself.
And I'm thinking in general, when you talk about the Scandinavian countries, those are the ones who treat parents, young parents, a lot better as well. They really give the support. I'm remembering something that went viral a few years ago with the babies sleeping in the boxes, because one of the countries gives you like a box that gives you pretty much all of the things you might need for the first year of your baby. And in the baby also, you know, including the box, which serves as like an early cradle. And
they have paternity leave in a lot of
months. And they have paternity leave. Yes, that's where I was going with that. So really, it's like from beginning of life on, there just seems to be this focus on taking care of the needs of the people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that there's no coincidence why life expectancy is so high out there, and also have the happiness quotient. I mean, it should be noticed, of course, that Norway is a pretty homogenous society, right? And so
yeah, that's definitely a difference.
Yeah.
So the process of writing this book, did you, because I know you are a writer to begin with and you're a poet, how long was the process of coming to, okay, now is the time I'm going to release this book, from when you started it?
Well, I think I knew I'm, as you mentioned, a pretty well-published poet and translator. And when I realized I was going to have to face this prospect, I knew that I would have to lean heavily on my identity as a writer to survive. And I almost initially thought of myself as an immersion journalist, kind of parachuted down into this space. And I filled probably a dozen composition books, you know, full of the conversations I was overhearing, the kinds of bureaucratic forms you had to fill out, the list of censored books and magazine articles, the smells and textures around me. It really was like clinched home when these men who I met, who initially I was really afraid of, and over this time, and I should mention this 90 days I did is kind of because I had a private attorney, was spaced out over about a year and a half. In retrospect, I kind of wished I had done it one time, because every time you have to be reprocessed and bend over and turned into a carceral object and put into a new group of men, it was really traumatic. But that first stretch, 45 days, I was with many of these men who shared really intimate stories, and they made me promise. They said, "You have a voice out there. We don't really have a voice, and we want you to do something with this." And I made him a promise. And so then I knew, okay, I'm going to have to write this book. What I didn't realize is it would take me almost 7 years to complete the project, that I really had to go through. I think initially I was really bitter. And I think part of this book is about me grappling with my own culpability and taking responsibility for the mistakes I might have made. And then I had an agent and many great readers who provided a lot of feedback. The thing about a memoir is that you're writing about people, in some cases, who don't want to be written about. And so how do you negotiate that? My ex-wife, for example, really didn't want to be written about, but she was a part of my story and my life. And then the larger contrivances of characterization and plot development. As a poet, I could describe with great visceral detail the inside of the space that I was in, but to keep the story moving, you know, that was something I had to kind of learn through revisions. And the book probably went through about 5 significant revisions. And then, because it was published with University Press, it had to go through what's called double blind peer review, where random 2 scholars read it and gave some more comments. And then I incorporated that. In one case, I got some pretty insightful remarks to edit it a final time. So it was really a pretty arduous process. And, you know, I excerpted little sections here and there in the New York Times and the Hartford Current and elsewhere, Daily Beast. But yes, the putting it together. And then I think I can talk a little bit about the structure, but I have these 6 letters in the book, which are the kind of architectural spine. And in India, they have 6 seasons in addition to the 4 we have now here. So there's the monsoon season, the season of heavy rain, and the pre-vernal that comes before spring. And so I, as each of these seasons, wrote a letter to someone in my life, kind of explaining my relationship with them and speaking directly to them in this intimate way. And, you know, I think those letters are kind of the poles around which the story of my life and even my grandparents and parents' life kind of furl around in some way. And so kind of getting that architecture also took a lot of time.
Yeah, and I love how you refer to it as architecture. It really was, the structure, how you put things together, it was really effective.
Thank you.
So if somebody is going to go pick this book up, going into it with any misconceptions or conceptions one might have, having never been incarcerated before, how would you hope that they approach it?
I think with an open mind and heart, absolutely. I mean, because I encounter men I never would have in my normal life. And I was frankly a little frightened of them before I met them. And in conversing with them, I realized that they are just as human as I am. They had the same dreams and aspirations. They might have come from less fortunate circumstances or had more adverse luck in their lives. But I found that they were really very human. And so I hope and complex, right? Just like all of us, there were complex individuals. I couldn't kind of reduce them to a 2D being. And so I think thinking about this idea of intentional inclusion and allowing us to bring into community all of those that are different than ourselves, whether ethnically or in terms of our ability, or if in fact we might have had a criminal record. And also, you know, as much as I hope that people, the readers, appreciate it for its craft and music and skill as a poet, I'm really invested in the language that I used. I also hope that it is not just a literary artifact, but makes people want to get involved and motivated and advocate for real change, because it is certainly possible. I think we need to lift our voices to make it happen.
Yeah, and I think you need to actually have people who are willing to make that leap. I think, a lot of people, myself included, you know, you hear how broken the system is and you're just like, oh man, if only, you know, the system didn't fail these people so much. But it saying it to your friends and, you know, tisking doesn't really solve too many problems if you're just tisking between people who agree and are your echo chamber.
Yes. But, you know, the easy thing is you really can get involved with local and national organizations that are doing a lot of this work. So from the Marshall Project to the Southern Poverty Law Center to the Vera Institute to in Rhode Island, I've been volunteering a little bit with Garden Time, which brings food knowledge and our horticultural skills to incarcerated men and women. And so there are ways you can get directly involved. And then of course, kind of talking to your legislatures and saying, because I end up thinking this is not a Democratic or Republican issue. It is a human issue. And it's a colossal waste of our taxpayer money if we're kind of financing a system that doesn't really work, that seems to have this covert racism really as part of its structural reason to exist. Why not dismantle it? And so especially for nonviolent drug offenders and the like, they certainly don't belong in prison. And I think writing to your legislators and kind of joining some of these organizations can help you make a difference. And it's better than just, I mean, I think we all like the tweet that comes by or.
I guess that's the public version of tisking. You're just like, oh yeah, I'm going to like and retweet that. But that's not calling your legislator with your actual voice and saying this is something that should be on your radar.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. By the time of this interview, Correctional will already be out and available. And if people would like to find out more about you, where can they find you? Do you have a website?
Yes, you can find me at poetravishankar.com. I'm also on the socials at Empurpler, Empurpler. I'm teaching creative writing at Tufts University and I live here in Providence. And I'm happy to reach out to visit any book clubs, salons, or be a resource in any way that I'm able. So thank you so much, Jessica. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh, you're welcome. And now I have to ask, what's in Purpler? Is purple your favorite color?
Well, purple is my favorite color, but in graduate school, the late poet Lucy Brock Broido, a terrific poet, told me in a workshop that I needed to pare down my language because I was an over-empurpler. And so she scolded me with it, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to own it. And in fact, I am an empurpler, and that's what I'll be.
I couldn't leave that without asking. It was just like, oh, wait a second, where is that from? But yeah, I think, you know, out of my years as an English major and a librarian, I only started hearing that term within the last 5 years. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. I guess I can understand what that means, but thank you for clarifying. I appreciate it. Hopefully the listener as well.
To make purple, to empurple, and usually as a pejorative connotation, but I think we can all use a little more purple in our lives.
Agreed. All right, this was Jessica. Our guest today was
Ravi Shankar.
And on behalf of Syosset Library, we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.